This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebounding Safety. This week, we are talking to Louise Hoskin in another episode of our mini-series talking all about diversity within the safety profession. Let's jump into the intro. I'll tell you some more about it. Let's go.
The problem in safety isn't deviation, it's complexity.
Health and safety has gone mad.
Health and safety is trying to unpick having gone mad in the past.
There's no one solution or one problem. The problem is that we are looking for one solution.
Does the structure of the team allow them to flourish?
Feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
The environment defines our behaviours.
People aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Rebranding Safety, crushing a stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Blue.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety is the YouTube channel and podcast doing exactly what it says on the tin. So if you're new here, hit subscribe, hit follow, hit whatever, like, follow button, algorithm, thingamajiggy. It all helps us get into other people's ear holes and faces. Thank you very much for that. Today is another episode of the diversity mini-series, so I'm going to give a little caveat in the moment and talk a little bit about today's guest. But before I do that, quick shout out to Paradigm Human Performance. Paradigm Human Performance plus Shane Bush are human and organizational performance experts. So if you're looking for support on how to get your human and your organization to perform better, then Paradigm is a place for you. They work all around the world with some amazing, massive companies, helping them be better, helping them put worker safety as core of their DNA, helping them understand and utilize the expertise of the workforce, helping them deal with human error, helping them deal with organizational drift and drift into failure and all of that stuff. These guys are amazing. Teresa's unbelievable. I love that lady, and her whole team are phenomenal. She's got a great team of consultants working with them, and they partnered with Shane Bush over in America as well, he's like an OG for HOP anyway. So what a great partnership, what a great company. And we wouldn't partner with them if we didn't believe in what they were doing. We really think that more of you out there should be considering HOP stuff for your organization. And if you're not quite sure, check out the Learning Organization webinar on their website as well. Email address, phone number, website, all in the description below. Check it. So today is another episode of the diversity mini series. Little caveat before we get into this. This is a bit of a sensitive space. I was very nervous about doing a mini-series on diversity, but I'm very passionate about it as well. I think it's something we need a hell of a lot more of. It's the right thing to do, 100%. But ultimately, it's more than just the right thing to do. It's this logical thing to do. If we've got the same kind of race and gender and age within the profession, then we're always going to get the same ideas. We need diversity to bring us cognitive diversity. If we want diversity of thought, then we've got to bring in diverse people. So this is a no-brainer for me, but ultimately a very sensitive space where we're all learning how to talk again. We're all learning what words are right, what words are wrong, how do we define ourselves. And it's as is any kind of learning and changing journey, it's uncomfortable. And so there are times that maybe I might slip up in a word I use. There are times that maybe my guests might slip up in the words they use or the phrase they say. But ultimately, please remember, we're all doing this for the right reason. Our purpose, our intent is positive. So if there is something where you think we could improve, if there is something where you think we didn't do great, then please let us know, 100%. But do it from a respectful position. Do it from a position to help us grow, because what we're doing here is a positive intent, and it's all about intent. So please, please, please feedback to us. If you've got anything to say, we welcome it. We really do. This is not me telling you to not tell us where we have failed or where we need to improve or whatever. This is me telling you, do it. But let's do it respectfully. Let's help each other grow on this journey. Thank you very much for listening to me on that. I really, really appreciate it. Today, we're talking to Louise Hoskin. At the time of recording this, Louise is the VP. The president-elect of IOSH. Now she is the president of IOSH. She's here on behalf of herself, talking about her career. So she also runs a company called Hoskins Associates. So she'll introduce herself very well in a moment. So thank you very much, Louise, for coming on. She's going to come on, talk about her career, being a woman, and what that's kind of like. So thank you very much. I'm going to stop waffling. Let's get into our conversation with Louise. Right, we're off. We're on. Louise, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, James. Thank you for having me.
No, that's all right. Thank you very much for coming on. Do you want to give us an introduction to yourself and an overview of your career, and then we'll get into talking about your
sure.
experiences?
I'm Louise Hosking. I grew up in Cambridge. And I guess I didn't kind of expect to go on to tertiary education. I came from quite a traditional kind of patriarchal household, and I think everybody kind of expected me to leave school at 16, and there weren't any huge aspirations for me, shall we say. But I think growing up in Cambridge, you've kind of got all that kind of education around you. I did science A-levels at college, and I went to Nottingham Trent where I studied environmental health, which is an amazing course, an amazing route into health and safety, actually. And there's more and more health and safety professionals that are coming through with environmental health degrees. And there's also an apprenticeship for that as well coming through now. So that was fantastic. I left there. I actually went back to Cambridge where I worked as an environmental health officer, which was great. It's a really proactive local authority. So, and I think it still is the case, they weren't afraid to use their powers. So as a regulator, I got quite used to going to court and prosecuting people. So I've kind of got that background as well. I moved on from there. And the reason why I kind of moved on is, well, I'm one of these people that I'm not happy with just identifying a problem. I've got to solve it and come up with a way to move things forward. And so I left the local authority because I didn't see myself long term as a regulator, and went to work for the co-op. So I remember you talking about your job, James, being very kind of boots on the ground, and I think that's what that role was all about. And I did food safety, health and safety, we called it pollution back then, so I was still using all my environmental health skills at that time. And one of the key aspects of what I was doing there, which I really enjoyed, was store refurbs and new store developments, just general sort of maintenance and repair. And I really got into that. And it was around the time when the CDM regulations were quite new. So I got really involved with the store redevelopment stuff and really liked it, and actually left the co-op to concentrate on that. So I moved into the construction sector and worked for a small consultancy doing CDM work. After that, I got more into kind of commercial property. And I was 31 when I became head of environmental health and safety at Savills, which was a really big job to have. But because I started, you know, I'm a first careerer, it seems like it's really early to have a job like that. But I was definitely ready for it. I was the first health and safety professional they'd ever had within the company. And I started off working in commercial property management, but actually ended up working across the group. So got involved in rural estates work, the estate agents, which everybody knows. They've got overseas offices as well. So that was kind of the role that I always wanted. But I kind of had a thing, you know, this is, we often talk about the corporate world, and, you know, I felt that corporates, certainly at that time, so this is like, I left there in 2005, from a health and safety perspective, they could honestly have done anything that they wanted, but there was still this you know, reluctance to see it as a real driver for success. And I wanted to help people that really needed to be helped. So I set up my business, which is predominantly to support smaller businesses. One of my first projects actually was working for the London Borough of Hillingdon, where I worked for the education team there and, you know, looked at all of their primary schools predominantly. So I'm very much working now with smaller organisations. I've worked with some schools, really broad cross section. I have to say commercial management is still a real love of mine. I do like a big building and getting into a good plant room. And at the top of some, you know, I've actually been to the top of some really impressive buildings around the UK. So yeah, I mean, that's what I do now. And I consider myself kind of part health and safety professional, part business owner, and there's a little bit left for me at the end of the day. That's kind of a wrap up, really.
It's funny you said about you love a good plant room. When I worked for the NHS, there is nothing better than a big hospital's plant room. Like,
yeah,
like the hum, you go in there and it's like,
yeah. And it's like, what does this bit do? I mean, I've always been really curious about things. And I think, you know, it's a good example of, you know, we need to be really curious in this job and constantly learning. And, you know, you can't know everything about everything, but if you meet a good, you know, the people that work in those environments want to talk about it, so you can pick up and learn a lot from them, I think.
Yeah, definitely. So we're going to try and aim, kind of focus our conversation around diversity in this conversation.
Yeah.
Because this is part of our like mini series when we're trying to just have some kind of, we've had a couple of people on that are kind of really just been open and honest about their stories. One guy came on and talked about his experience of the gay man in America, and then Jesse Gomez, who you probably know, talks about being French and of an ethnic minority as well, and a mother and the challenges that she's gone through as well. And then Crystal Danbury on as well, who's talked about being a woman in some really male dominated environments. So I'd be interested to kind of just kind of put the question, a really simple question out there, which really shouldn't be a question, but like, what is it like as a woman going through, like, was there in the local authority, was it local authority or HSC you worked
for? Local authority, yeah. And
was that really male dominated, or was that quite diverse, or?
That's a really good question, because environmental health is really different. So when I was at uni, and I'm getting on a bit now, James, I'm definitely not an Irish reader. I went to uni in 1988, and I was on a 3-year full-time course, and the third year, when I was in the first year, was 75% male, 25% female. The second year was 50-50, okay. And my year was split. So it was like this point in time when environmental health switched. And actually in environmental health now, it is predominantly women, and nice. They're much younger cross-section as well.
Well, that's interesting.
Which is really interesting.
That is interesting. And that's why I didn't know that, but I just wondered, is it any different there, or is it the same? Because we come across so many industries that are, you know, unless it's like the care industry, nearly every other industry is just kind of so male dominated, isn't it?
But the really interesting thing was when I worked at the local authority, and I could probably do a whole one of your shows on my great stories of being an environmental health officer.
I bet, yeah.
My role was food safety and health and safety. So I predominantly did the health and safety in food premises.
Yeah.
I still investigated. I remember investigating an incident where somebody in a large commercial kitchen actually tipped an entire massive pot of boiling water down the back of somebody else. So you know, I was kind of thrust into it at a really early age. But it was, you know, there was definitely at that time, and certainly working for Cambridge, and because I was new, I didn't ever feel that my gender at that point was an issue. Although saying that, there was a health and safety team within the department that looked after health and safety in the council. Right. And pure health and safety. And that health and safety team was two old boys who sat in an office on their own.
What about your youth? Was that because you've said a few times, you know, you were in roles that you were maybe potentially perceived as being a bit young for that because you were a first career, or whereas the majority of safety professionals are, I think it'd be fair to say, second career. I also think that's something I could relate to. Like, it wasn't really I kind of say I'm a bit of a first careerer because I didn't really have a career before, but I just had a shitload of jobs. Like, I started in safety at about 2021, I think it was. Mm. Not the year 2021, obviously, but 20 to 21-ish around that period. So for me, it was kind of like a first career.
Started at the same age.
Okay. So, and for me, I've always thought that youth was a big thing. Like, yeah. There's an assumption that if you're young, you haven't got a clue.
So I have this theory that is completely my theory, which is, you know, between the age of 20 and 30, the issues that I faced were in terms of bias, and we all have bias, were around my age.
Yeah.
Once I sort of reached my mid-30s, it became a gender issue. So I have this theory that gender becomes more of a predominant bias that we see the further up the ladder that you go, the further on with your career that you become. So for me... And although saying that, I worked for incredible people in my 20s who gave me a really strong foundation, which I think is so important in this profession, because it means that people can throw things at me now and I've got a really strong resilience, which I think those early, you know, my early career gave me. But I think age was definitely a factor for me when I was in my 20s,
yeah.
More so than my gender.
Why do you think
I didn't think about my gender as being an issue in my 20s.
Well, that's good. In a way, yeah, that's good. Why do you think, what's the reasoning behind your theory? Why do you think the gender starts to rear its head in the more senior or the more older that you get?
So I actually think what happens is that, you know, we predominantly in your early career, you're probably not going to be in a pure leadership role. So I think it starts to become an issue as, you know, for women who are moving into leadership roles. And I think, you know, thankfully this is changing, but I think in the past, you know, management styles of control, coercion, you know, command and control has proven to be a really successful way to get on in business.
Mm.
And so if people can see that, you know, command control works, that becomes the predominant style. Mm. And I don't think that fits with people that have more feminine traits. So this is, I mean, you were saying one of your guests was you've had a, you know, gay man coming on and talking about, you know, and so, you know, and again, everybody's different, but I think though it's those feminine traits, they don't fit with command, control, coercion.
Yeah.
You know, so we tend to, you know, certainly within my career, I've never been able to use command and control. So I've had to learn to take, you know, I take people with me when I'm doing things. But I think the further up the ladder you get, that command and control is still, I feel, the predominant management style. We haven't worked it all through yet. And I think the further up the tree that you get, you know, the fewer jobs there are, there's more competition. And I think people with feminine traits find that competitive environment extremely challenging. It's really hard, you know. We have all of these emotions. People with feminine traits have lots of emotion, lots of empathy, and it's easier to avoid those difficult situations. So we lose people.
Yeah, that's really interesting you say that, because I definitely have never been able to command and control. Like, it's even as a younger kind of safety professional, it's never sat right with me. I've never been really comfortable with it. And I think that's why, you know, this movement to New View and all that just works really well with me, because it removes work from that. And that's why it just works for me so well, because it speaks to my inner being. And when I look back onto what you just said, like feminine traits, for me, like, I was raised by women, like literally, you know, kind of like Mowgli was raised by wolves. I was raised by women. My grandma was my dad, and my mum was obviously my mum. And it definitely, those feminine traits speak stronger in me than the male traits. I'm no psychologist or anything like that, but you know, when you learn a little bit of psychology as we do in our role, you can start to pick out some of this stuff. And I think what you've just said there, I think that makes a lot of sense, and that speaks to me definitely.
I think another conversation that I've had with you, James, that I really remembered, we were talking about our why we do things. I grew up in a command and control household. Okay. With, you know, big penalties if you didn't comply with that command and control. I remember you saying to me that your why was around fairness.
Yeah.
And that's my why as well, is I just hate to see unfairness.
Yeah.
And that for me has always been my bigger driver. And I think because I've stood up to command and control from a very early age, I've just kept going.
Yeah.
You know, I've just kept going. And, you know, hopefully I can, you know, my big hope for the future is that I can make it better for the next generation behind me.
Yeah, that the fairness thing is just, it took me a long time to probably realize that, but I think empathy and fairness for me and respect for people, they speak heavily to me, like really deeply they speak to me. It's never sat with me, like anything that I might personally deem as unfair, and fairness is probably a relative term, but when I was a kid, this is such a pathetic story, but when I was a kid, I played football in I think it was like a lunchtime thing. I don't know. And our ref was the head teacher. And anyway, we had this little football tournament or whatever it was. And we did this like prize draw in assembly, right? And he said, "Oh, I've made up a new award because I was so impressed by this person during the football that I wanted to give them an award." And we were all a bit like, "Oh, what's this?" Mm-hmm. I just realized it's gone really dark in here. I'll sort that out in a minute. And anyway, he went, "This is for the fairest player." And then he called my name, and I was like, "Oh, you're joking. I'm going to get bullied for this for years." And I had a chocolate bar, and that was it. But he was like, every time the ball went out, if he went, you know, he was trying to teach us fair play. It's what he was trying to teach us. So he turned around and would say, "Whose ball is it?" And I would always go, "It's their ball or it's my ball." And that was, no one taught me that. I just kind of did it. Like, it was always so, the why stuff speaks to me a lot, because it's, I think when you really get down to it and you look at it, it's those little things that no one taught you, but you just did, and it just worked because it's you in a nutshell.
Yeah, so for me, that, you know, that whole fairness thing, and the other thing, I mean, people, it's amazing how people, if we're talking about bias, we could talk about all the biases here. So, you know, as soon as I say, oh, you know, I grew up in Cambridge, and people kind of, it's amazing how that kind of has an instant, gives people an instant perception as well. But a fact about Cambridge that lots of people don't know is that it's actually the most divided city in the UK between the haves and the have-nots. And when you work for a local authority, which is why I said I could do an entire show probably about being an EHO, is I saw firsthand some of that poverty and some of that unfairness. And so I guess that's why I loved my time working in the corporate world. But that wasn't where I, you know, I felt like I could do more by working in, like, you know, for companies and organizations that needed it more. And again, sometimes you have, you know, you then have a perception because you don't have a big shiny corporate job. And so, you know, yeah, I think in health and safety, we all need to be a little bit less judgmental perhaps sometimes.
Yeah, I think that class thing is really interesting. Like, you're touching on the kind of upper, middle and lower classes.
Yeah, it's social bias, isn't it?
It is. And that, I genuinely think a lot of that, especially in the UK or especially in England, is deep rooted. Like, I'm working class, straight up working class background, to the point my teacher even said to me, you'll never get more than a warehouse job or something like that. Mm. And not that there's anything wrong with that.
And it sticks with you for a long time.
Yeah. And not that there's anything wrong with working in a warehouse. You can get a shitload of money working in a warehouse. But, like, it's I remember thinking, like, wow, okay, fair enough. And I wanted to either work in theatre or be a journalist. And she kind of laughed at me. You know, I was full on working class, and I was just never meant to be anything more than what society deemed me to be. And I've experienced a lot of bias from that point of view, 100%. And a lot of bias from the youth point of view. And never in my entire life, up until my wife was pregnant, have I experienced sexism. And I experienced sexism when I was an expecting father. I genuinely think that the only time a male will really experience sexism, unless they're maybe in a working in a female dominant environment, I couldn't comment for that, but is when you're an expecting father. You just assume that you don't know what you're talking about, that you're only there because your wife told you to be there, that you don't really care because that's what the stereotype of a dad is, apparently. And God, I remember the first or the second meeting I had. I think I said this to Crystal as well, because we ended up talking quite heavily around maternity and paternity. And I remember saying, coming out of a meeting at a local hospital, it was just before COVID, because that was it. It was one of the first ones because COVID stopped me from going to any others. And I'd always said, when Sherry fell pregnant, I was like, I'm going to be at all of them. Like, I'm uber involved. Like, I want to be at there. I want to see you. I want to know you're okay. I want to know my baby's okay. I want to help. I want to be involved. Like, it was really important to me to be involved. No one's ever told me to be like that. Like, and I just wanted to be involved. And being a good dad is really important to me. Like, and it is to all dads. I get that. But, like, it was just so important to me. And I sat in this meeting, and the woman, the stuff she was saying was just like, you know, we better hurry up so daddy can get back to work. And I'm just like, okay, all right.
Wow, yeah, that's a good comparison.
you're saying that, like, I don't want to be here. Like, we better hurry up so daddy wants to be here. No, you take your fucking time, love, because I'm here because I want to be here. Or she said something else around, like, oh, do you know what that means, daddy? And I'm just like, if you call me daddy one more time, I swear I'm going to.
You know, this is, so when because I do talk about this subject a lot, which, you know, and I always balance this with the fact that, you know, when we talk about gender equality, it's not just a women's issue, it's an organizational issue. And we need to have balance. We need to have balance of thought, but also we need to give men back that balance too. So we know that when men choose to take, you know, we've had shared parental leave in this country for a long time, and we know that when men take shared parental leave, they face the same discrimination that women do. And actually, when we you know, I'm a big advocate for part-time flexible working, and always have been. It shouldn't be part of a job, but actually, why shouldn't that be open to men too? So, you know, in achieving this, I love talking at gender balance. I love to, you know, I'd much rather, I think that's a good phrase to put to it. It works in both ways. We know that, you know, the suicide rates for young men is too high because they take all of this on board. They feel that they've got to be the breadwinner. They've got to be the one who's in charge, taking responsibility all the time. Mm. And actually, if we can achieve that balance, we're going to create more harmony for men and for women, for people with masculine traits and feminine traits.
And that, in a nutshell, is why I think just having these conversations is so important. Like, you know, my podcast or any safety podcast is a tiny drop in the ocean compared to some of the massive podcasts out there. But the more and more professions that have this conversation around, you know, yes, we're talking about your experiences as a woman. And yes, when we talked to Sam, we were talking about his experiences as a gay man. And I think the telling the stories of those experiences is good because it creates empathy for people that haven't experienced it, and they're powerful. But we're not sitting here saying, oh, you know, all safety professionals should be women, or all of them should be, you know, transgender or something like that. What we're saying is it's all of the above, because like, to your point, you mentioned there, like cognitive diversity or diversity of thought, that is innovation in a nutshell. You ain't going to get nothing unless you really start to diversify your pool of ideas. And the only way you do that is by having diverse people. So for
me, I think the other kind of issue that health and safety has kind of suffered from in the past as well is, you know, people thinking, right, you know, this is what it says, this is what's written down in the law, so this is what you have to do. And you know, there has been, you know, it's the way that organizations and businesses look at this. You know, they still want to be able to tick a box and fix health and safety. They don't see it as a journey and part of their DNA. Mm. And so when we've got those kind of attitudes to this is right and that's wrong, it translates into I'm right, you're wrong. And I desperately feel we need to learn to disagree with each other better. Mm. Because if we can hear somebody else speak and allow them space to speak and respect a different perspective, we're going to make better health and safety decisions. And if we make better health and safety decisions, guess what? We're going to save more lives. Mm. So, you know, I think it has come from, you know, it's definitely come from, you know, health and safety's grown up from construction, heavy industry, that kind of thing, which is why it's been predominantly a male-led profession. But we're now realizing that we can't create a health and safety perspective within an organization that's part of its DNA if we are using command, control and coercion. It just doesn't work. And as we start to talk more about health, we are going to see that, you know, health, psychology, you know, ergonomics, that kind of thing is going to attract more women. And I do think we've kind of got this clash of worlds going on at the moment where women are trying to push themselves forward and they are hitting, you know, those barriers?
Well, I think that just we operate in, I think to your point about the tick in the box, we operate in a world where it's everything seems to be one or the other. Are we a technical profession, or are we a kind of soft skills profession? You know, are we psychologists or are we engineers? No, we're all of the above. Mm-hmm. And we need all of the above. Like, I think I made a video about this a while ago, but like, there's an assumption that, and I bang my head against this brick wall so many times with so many big organizations within safety, and that, you know, so we're acknowledging these so-called soft skills, but we're acknowledging them as a one, in my opinion, lip service, because we're so scared that they're going to overpower the technical skills, and that it's soft skills in spite of the sets, the technical skills, or overpowering the technical skills. Like, no, it's, I still want somebody who is like uber engineering focus. Like, if I'm going to build myself a team tomorrow, I want someone who is like fine detailed.
You'll need me on your commercial management side.
But like, I want an engineer. I want someone that loves the technical details. I want somebody, especially in big safety, you know, work, I want stuff like that. But I also want someone who is really understanding of the softer skills, that knows how to build relationships, that understands how to be empathetic and build, you know, connections with people, so that they can influence, so that we can take the knowledge from the engineer, we can design out as much as possible, but then we have to hit that influencing safety person, or whatever we want to call them, the softer skilled person, and let them work their magic. It's both in tandem. It's not one against each other.
I think, you know, we talk a lot about health and safety leadership, and I think people need to understand the difference between what makes a leader and what makes a manager. I think we have lots of good health and safety managers who want to tell you how to follow the system. Whereas for me, leadership is using your people and fitting, you know, is creating an environment where your people can flourish. So we become facilitators. I mean, I'm not a particularly good hazard spotter anymore, because, you know, I see my role as going into businesses to create space so that they can make the decisions for their organization. Exactly. that are the best decisions for their organization. And if we get it right, it filters all the way down. So everybody's making risk-based choices for themselves and for the person that's working next to them. Mm. And that's why those skills are so important. But you're right, you've still got to know your technical stuff. You know, I still, you know, I know my technical health and safety. I know my legislation, you know, and, you know, experience is still really important. But I to go back to the age thing, I've always sat and I've never been able to command, because it's not just that, you know, I'm a woman, I'm quite a girly girl as well. And so you have to sit with people and figure it out, and they come and you work together on your problems. Mm. You know, I mean, when I was at the co-op, when I had that job from about 23, I think, and it was just after the six pack had come out. So older viewers will remember the six pack, but it was the Pure, Lola, manual handling regs, PPE regs. They literally descended, and we had to do risk assessments. And at 23, I was given the project to do the manual handling risk assessments for the whole of the non-food division. And they kind of trusted me to get on with it. And I would go around the stores and figure out how they did stuff with the people that worked there. And they gave me the solutions. And I guess it's kind of gone with me throughout my career. But I think we need to work with the profession to say, you know, you don't have to have all, it's okay not to have all of the answers and to use those kind of skills. Mm-hmm. And that is definitely a more feminine trait than a masculine trait. Mm-hmm.
I suppose, come back to your other point when you mentioned about like the kind of male suicide rate. I think they were just pondering a thought as you kind of said that. In that males are kind of as you could, we've always got to be the ones with the answers. So when you put all this context together, you know, let's kind of safety this a little bit. Let's do a sort of like investigation kind of around it. I mean, if you look at it, let's try and. So what's the problem? The problem is this command and control approach where safety professionals are really like, we must have all the answers. And
I have to have all these. I have to tell you what to do. I have to be in control.
Exactly. And then we're trying to tell this new, these old safety professional, not old in age, just old in maybe approach or whatever, or maybe not old in approach. God, this is a minefield. Anyway, but we're trying to tell you, no, it's not about having the answers. It's about understanding and facilitating the answers that the shop floor has. Okay. Mm-hmm. But actually, then when you look at the context of this, it's like, okay, majority of safety professionals are male, and the majority of males, society tells them they must be the breadwinner, they must have all the answers, they must protect people, they must be the man. I remember being a kid and my mum saying, you're the man of the house, James.
I grew up with a father that was so, like, you know, I have to have all of the answers, I know the answers to, you know. And it's these people that know every single regulation inside out. They know, you know, they've been there, they've done it, and they have to exude that. But actually, when you exude that in a workplace, it intimidates other people and it takes away innovation. It takes away creativity. And it's quite soul destroying. And well, I think
it's kind of fascinating that we've gone down this point, I think, because there's a great documentary on Netflix and Netflix Explained series where they're talking about the gender pay gap. And actually, the couple of things that came out of that is that they said it's not a gender pay gap, it's a parental pay gap. And that actually societies, businesses, organizations, governments, etc., need to make it one, socially acceptable for the man to not go back to work and be the dad, to stay at home.
100%.
And facilitate that through the leave that they get paid. Yeah. And this is very similar problem. Like, we need to make it societally acceptable for the men to not have the answers, for men to be a bit more feminine traits, so to speak, you know. But then also make it acceptable that you don't have those feminine traits, and that's a good thing as well. So in a way, we just need to accept that it's all of the above, and that actually this is really chaotic, but that's pretty good.
But you know something else, James, something else that I've often said as well, that gender bias is not gender specific. So you can have situations where other women in leadership positions will favour a male in a leadership role. You know, I've had comparisons being made to me by people that I consider to be peers, but they think, oh, well, they're less experienced than you, you know, and people make assumptions about me because I'm a woman, because I'm quite, you know, I've got quite a feminine voice, you know, command just doesn't exist in my vocabulary. So you know, I think some of the issues that I've faced have been because of that. People assume.
Yeah. No, they do. We judge without
context
a lot of the time.
And that's not just men, it's men and women those assumptions very quickly.
Do you think, I'm going to completely change the direction of this conversation, just that you were talking about biases, and it reminded me of something. Remember when we were building all those temporary hospitals for COVID, right?
Yeah.
And can you remember China building one in like one day or something like that? Loads of videos came out of like how quick they were whizzing around, so all these trucks, and it just looked chaotic. And I remember all of the comments from, you know, UK-based safety professionals, and not just safety professionals, you know, UK operations managers and directors of this and directors of that, all making assumptions that site wasn't safe and that we're better than them at safety. Do you think we have a bias in the UK as being better than everyone else at safety, or maybe?
Now you're talking about cultural biases, which is fascinating stuff as well. Is, you know, I mean, health and safety is a great UK export, there's no question about it. But I genuinely believe that we can all learn from each other, and we can, you know, we can grow and develop via the things that we learn from other places. And if we have to stop being judgmental about each other. You know, I Sri Lanka is, I went on holiday and met some health and safety professionals in Sri Lanka because that's
you
what I
do. Sad person.
And I've stayed in contact with them ever since. And that's a fascinating country because they haven't banned asbestos. You know, there's very few regulations in place in Sri Lanka. They lose a lot of men to suicide in Sri Lanka. They lose a lot of men from chemicals that they're using on the fields in Sri Lanka. But these guys are starting to, they're starting to develop their health and safety framework, and it's very much being led by, you know, health and safety professionals that might be working for global corporates, and they're going back into the country to, you know, everybody wants to improve their own country. And I genuinely believe we can learn a lot from them as they're developing their system. So we need to learn from each other, and we cannot, you know, we're much more aware of our global world now than we ever have been. And I think we need to grasp that as an opportunity. And we need to stop. We need to stop judging each other, don't we?
Definitely.
That's what this is all about.
We need to stop making an assumption that we know best, and that someone in front of us is just judging without context. And the reason I asked this question is because it just, some of the stuff we were saying was just so fascinating. And I was reminding me of a conversation I had with one of the members of Project Miletium, actually. And he said a fascinating question, just on a one-to-one phone call with him. Where do you think the next, like, big kind of innovation of safety is going to come from around the world? Where's the next big thing of safety going to come from? Who's going to change the safety world? And I was just like, who's going to change the safety world? There's like so much good stuff coming out of Australia right now.
Yeah, there is.
So I'm probably like, maybe Australia. And he was like, no, I think it's going to be like somewhere like India or something like that. And I was like, okay, and like elaborate on it. And he kind of went on.
That's why these countries can take our learning and develop it in a modern environment, and they could easily start to teach. But we've all got to be open to learn and listen from that too.
And I think it also, if you look at it, like what I think is fascinating about what Peter said was it's kind of the different environment that they have, in that maybe their priorities are different. Like if you look at, like, one, you know, India, Asia as a collective, I suppose, and then the Emirates as well, they're all got the emerging technologies all coming from there. So one, they're embedded with technology, right? And as nations, they are, if you look at like the Emirates, for example, United Emirates, they are just 100% up the wazoo. We are turning our countries from deserts to, you know, buzzing cities, and I don't care how we do it, get it done. So as a safety professional, like, okay, I don't care how we do it, got to get it done, but we don't want to kill anyone. So like, I want to hear, how did they manage that? So when they come over to us, we just look at them maybe as a bias and go, you don't know what you're doing, we're the best at safety. But actually, damn, you try doing safety in that environment. And I just,
you can't rest on your laurels, can you? I mean, you know, I think we were probably one of the first, you know, well, the Health and Safety at Work Act 1974, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Way older than you, probably, James.
Just a bit.
Is, you know, it brought into being a risk-based approach. And so we created that risk-based approach in the UK, but other people are going to take that risk-based approach and I think turn it on its head. Because if you can combine a risk-based approach with modern leadership skills, you won't need legislation. Yeah. Oh, that's an idea, isn't it? You know, you won't need rules.
You're talking my language now. Like, I was in a fascinating conversation the other day where we were talking around violations of rules and punishing those rules and so on and so forth, and how it doesn't really achieve what we want it to achieve, right? Okay. And they said, well, this one guy said, well, that doesn't sit comfortably for me. What about like speeding? You know, we break the speed and then we get our points on our license, we lose our car, whatever. And I get what he was saying, 100% get what he's saying, and I kind of agree with him. But my question is, does it work? No, it doesn't work, because how long have we had speed limits in place and how long have we been challenged and dealing with this issue? No matter how many cameras, how many smart highways, no matter how many control measures we put in place, no matter how many like speed awareness courses, which FYI, I've been on one or maybe two of them, and they're really good. They're really good. You learn loads of stuff. I thought, yeah, I was just going to get my wrist slapped and get told off like a copper for like a half an hour to an hour. But actually, it just educated me, which I loved. But anyway, but it's not solved the problem. So actually, this is where I think diversity comes in 100%, because you're going to get someone from China who built that hospital in 24 hours. And we like, oh, what rules did you have in place? What policies, what procedures? And they went, we didn't.
Yeah.
Haven't. Yeah. We just got it done. Oh, you must have killed loads of people. No, we didn't kill anybody. Oh, but when we built the Olympic Village and
didn't. Yeah, no, I honestly believe this could happen. I do believe this can happen with the right approach. You've still got to understand the concepts of modern risk management, and you've got to understand business. I like hanging out with podcasters that talk about disruptive MBAs as well, and they're having the same conversations around this. So those organizations that want to look at it differently and really go for it are going to thrive in that arena, but you're still going to have a lot of companies and a lot of smaller companies that need to have a legislative framework to move forward. So I think, I mean, one of the things that I've written about in the past is I think there's going to be, I started off the conversation talking about Cambridge being this socially divided city. And I think something that could come out of the pandemic is that we have a social divide in health and safety as well. So at the one end, you've got organizations that have grasped this technological revolution that we're going through, who are able to use the data and the learning and, you know, how we've all, you know, applied ourselves in at this time. And then at the other end of the scale, you've got businesses that are just hanging on by their fingertips, cutting costs left, right and center, are going to be left behind. And so, you know, how are we gonna measure that?
Yeah, that's fascinating. Isn't it funny that you have a conversation about diversity and this is where we brought us to? And does that not say in a nutshell like the power of talking about this stuff?
Yeah. I mean, the reason it's always excited me, because I love building teams, and I love being in groups of people that are massively different. And, you know, one of the things I did before lockdown, actually, I like hanging out with psychologists. And one of my psychology friends, who's a professor at University of London, actually created, they've been doing this thing called a warm data lab. And so they pose a question and then put people into groups. And literally you can have a discussion in a group and you move from group to group, depending on whether you like that conversation or not. And you can actually solve problems in that way and come up with some really interesting stuff. So it kind of all comes back to how we're communicating with each other, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's funny, just as you were talking, I was thinking in my head, like, what we're talking about here is actually not diversity, it's inclusion. Because it comes back to that point
that
you can buy diversity, but you can't buy inclusion. And we could attract as many, you know, ethnic minorities, as many ethnicities, as many genders, as many sexual preferences, whatever. You know, young people, old people, first of career, second of career. But it doesn't matter unless we get rid of those biases, we stop assuming that we know, but we accept them, and we create some psychological safety within our own profession. Because at the moment, we don't have that. We're very clicky, we're very judgmental.
You know something, psychological safety within an organisation, I believe, is, you know, and I'm saying this from the perspective of being a business owner as well as a health and safety professional, is one of the most important pieces of the puzzle, because you want your people to put their hand up and say, this isn't working for me. And to create an environment where people can say that, it's not as easy as you think. Because as business owners, you know, I'm not just thinking, I've got to think of so many things. Have I done my VAT return? Am I sticking to HR rules? You know, we've had all the issues around COVID. Can my team cover their childcare? You know, running a business is hard. It's not easy. And so resorting to this command and control can feel like it's the easiest route to go down.
It's the safest, isn't it? And I think this is the irony of it. Like, I had this bit of a realization the other day, in that a lack of psychological safety provides psychological safety for the person that doesn't want psychological safety. Because actually, as a business leader, psychological safety is really scary. Like, you're saying, I want you to tell me everything. I want you to be honest with me. And that could potentially mean you turning around and going, James, I hate it when you do this, and this is really incompetent, and we could do it this way, which is this way would be so much better. And for me, that's really scary and uncomfortable if I'm running a company. So actually, ironically, I feel psychologically safe because we don't have psychological safety.
You know, if we think about command and control and coercers being very successful in the past, you know, they're going to continue with that style. And actually, now we're saying to them, you know, you've got a workforce that is stressed out, burnt out, everything else. To achieve psychological safety, you have to evaluate how you feel about this first. And it is hard. Yeah. It's really hard. Yeah. Every time I say to one of my team, how are you doing? Is there anything that I can do that's differently? I'm scared about what they're going to come back with, you know, but it's important. And I think another word that I remember you talking about when we've been talking about before is about trust.
Yeah.
Too. That's huge, huge too.
Massive. Like, I don't understand why you would employ someone and then not trust them. It doesn't make sense to me. Because if you don't trust them, you shouldn't have bloody employed them. So,
well, that can be quite difficult because there's not enough people. You know, sometimes you think there's not enough people to go around either.
So then I think that's where we start to, but there's not enough people to go around. And then also we end up, it's a really difficult place where we're so scared sometimes to have the conversation to say, I don't think you're right for this company, and I don't think we're right for you. And actually, that's a good thing, because it means there's a company out there that's right for you, and it means there's someone out there that's right for me. Like, we make it this thing that, like, we don't want you because you're incompetent. Actually, sometimes you're just not right for our culture.
And
that's one of the issues with diversity, is that sometimes it just doesn't work, I think. And that's a good thing. Like, some people cannot stand my podcast. I guarantee it. There is somebody out there, one day they'll message me and they'll say, FYI, James, I just wanted to say, I think your work is crap. Right? And that's a good thing. That's a good thing, because it means, frankly, if the world was full of Jameses, I'd still argue with myself. Do you know what I mean? It would be, we need loads of different people talking in different ways. And it sounds scary. It sounds chaotic, but I think it's a really good thing. But it's hard.
It is. And I mean, one of the things that I said to you before we came on was, yeah, I can talk till the cows come home at some of the hideous experiences that I've had. And, you know, hearing the generations coming through and experiencing the same things, it just gets me right in here. But I do believe the way that we're going to overcome this is to not look back, but to look forward. Which is why, have you heard of my one wish that I have got? Have you heard of One Wish? So One Wish stands for Women and Inclusion in Safety and Health, and it's something that kind of got created last year. And we had a big congress at International Women's Day. So we pulled together women and leaders. So it's not just women, because that can create a silo in its own, who are really, you know, want to move forward in this arena for health and safety. So we've got organizations from literally around the world involved in this, and the congress started in Australia and finished in Australia, in America. So we followed the time zones through, hugely successful. But we had a theme, and that was about looking forward. It was about creating, because women are afraid to step up and be seen to be kind of out there. And I can really relate to that.
Why are women afraid?
I think what it is because to move forward, you've got to be visible, especially now. And you feel like you're being pushy, or, right, you know, you feel like you're drawing attention to yourself.
It's that kind of old analogy of a man, good leader, a woman, she's bossy, like that, those kind of memes that you see on social media.
Yeah. So, you know, I have always felt like I've got to be better than the next best man to do the things that I do.
Okay.
And the minute I've had people say to me, you're just all over the place, you know, and actually I'm thinking, am I really? But that kind of stink sticks. And we have this kind of likability factor as women, is that really strong male leaders can be unlikable but still successful. And I think that's much harder for women.
Yeah.
And so that whole visibility piece is really challenging for us. So as part of what we're doing in One Wish, as part of what we did in that congress, was basic, and part of what I do too is, and it terrifies me too, by the way, is, you know, it's okay to be visible. It's okay to be out there. It's okay to be having a conversation. It's okay to be somebody that other people see on LinkedIn or in social media, or all over the place. So that visibility is really key. And just giving women the confidence to step forward by surrounding them with other people, strong people that share this view that we're kind of discussing right now. Because the reason why, you know, and I've seen this an awful lot, is you can't underestimate sponsorship. So what we need to do is we need to give women and other underrepresented groups that support from the highest levels. So we need to get women and underrepresented groups into the highest posts around the world. And so that sponsorship's created.
Yeah.
And it's massively important, because, I mean, people, we look at things through a male lens, you know. At the Congress, we had the chief executive, Karen James, spoke from ERM, and they've done some research, and I mean, they're a big global organisation that does a lot of research around health and safety. And they, because we asked her to speak at this Congress, she kind of went back and looked at some statistics. And they carried out research in 270-odd of the largest organisations in the world. And they found that 15% of them had women health and safety leaders at a high, as a high, you know, within a significant role in those organisations. And that was compared to 29% in the same organisations at the same level. So what that means is that we're not promoting women into health and safety leadership positions in the same way that we would other leadership.
Oh, right. I'm with you. So in finance or HR or something exactly. like that, or operations, there is 29%, but in safety, it's 15%. Yeah. Oh, okay. I'm with you.
So then if you take that figure and you put that into a predominantly male environment like mining, construction, offshore, we're looking at health and safety through a male lens. We're not looking at health and safety in the way that it affects our entire workforce. We're going to miss stuff.
And there's such a good example of it in I talk about this book all the time, but Rebel Ideas by Matthew Syed. I don't know if you've read it.
Yeah.
Such, and the fish tank
example. I hate rules. I'm a real rebel.
Can you remember the fish tank example, the research that you talked about in there? There's a little story it talks about in the book where they got a load of American people to verbally describe the fish tank, a load of, I think it was Japanese people to verbally describe the fish tank. And the American people described, I might have got this the wrong way around, but they described the fish. So the fish tank with a big fish in it, there was four fish, one was red, one was blue, right? The Japanese people, and again, this could be the other way around, but the Japanese people, they didn't even barely mention the fish. They described the context. So they were like, the sand was like a yellowy color. There was lovely red, purple, green plants and stuff like that. The water was really clear. And it showed that the difference in cultures means you physically see things differently. And now you take that and apply that to safety at the moment. 75% last I saw were over 50 or something like that, or over 45 of our profession. You know, they're a few years away from retiring, whatever, right? And they're predominantly male. And they're predominantly white. That is 75% of our profession is looking through one lens. So if we only see the fish in that tank, we are never going to see the context around that fish. We're only going to see that. So we are physically missing things.
Yeah, we are. And so, you know, is this the reason why we've been at a plateau in terms of our accident statistics, our incident statistics? Is that what's the saying? You can't carry on doing the same things and expect to get better results.
Exactly.
So you know, if you look at the UK stats in terms of this, I mean, the big drop came when we stopped mining and we stopped manufacturing and everything else. But actually, we've been at a plateau for such a long time.
Yeah.
And so we're not going to solve that by continuing the way that we've always done everything. Yeah. We've got to look at things through a different lens. We've got to look at the way that we speak to each other. We've got to look at our language. We've got to disagree better.
Yeah. I think we need to really challenge what you were just talking about, like a language, like what our norm is. And I think it's a shame we're kind of coming to running out of time, but because I think when I mentioned this person and the work she's doing, I think me and you could talk about her for a very long time. But the work that Chloe Hughes is doing around menstrual cycles and menopause And I think that's going to be really uncomfortable for a lot of men to listen to. And
100%.
I've chased her a few times to get her on this bloody podcast to come and talk about it, period. see what I did there. And but, you know, I think that's really uncomfortable. I, you know, for a long time, it was uncomfortable for me to talk about. And now I've got a daughter now. And you know, and I'm saying to my wife, like, we need to make it completely comfortable for her to talk about that thing that is 100% natural to her in front of me, because I want to make sure that if it's anything ever wrong and you're not around, Sherry, she can come to me.
Yeah.
You know, and we need to do that at work as well.
Yeah. And you know something, this is where, you know, I am on the older side of that scale. I find that really uncomfortable to talk about, you know? And so if I think it's something that, you know, the younger generations are definitely much more comfortable in talking about this. I've definitely come from a generation where you just keep going, whatever.
Yeah.
And lots of women are very, very ill for gynecological reasons. You know, they don't talk about it and they just carry on.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
And it's dangerous for them and for the company. You know, menopause can really change and put a woman through some crazy ass shit. And she's coming to work and running your machine. Like, you want to have an environment where she can say to you, you know, I'm having hot flushes right now, or my vision's changing. You know, it can do some really crazy stuff. And because you're not making it comfortable as a company, not just a company, but as a society, we're not making it comfortable to talk about that stuff. It, you know, it's creating issues. All the most vulnerable things that we have in our lives, like finance, sex, politics, you know, our genitals and our menstrual cycles and menopause, they're all taboo to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, people get in so much trouble around finance, around sex and anything like that. But we as a society say, we don't talk about that stuff. We don't talk, but like, that is the stuff we need to make okay to talk about. I am financially
I do wonder why, you know, this has probably come from women feeling, if I open up about my femininity, I am going to be judged differently. I mean, I it's in my professional career. When I was an EH, I can't even remember. I would have been in my 20s, you know, when I was looking to move around and what my next steps might be, there would be adverts for people with my qualifications to work in the Middle East, and they would say no women.
Wow.
So, you know, that's in my professional life, and those things are very ingrained.
Creates a heuristic in your brain, doesn't it? Yeah. It's I think we've got a long way to go, but I can see a lot of change coming, and I hope we keep these conversations going, and I think it's good, and I think the change is powerful, and I think work that, you know, people like Chloe are doing and work that you've done over the years and are still doing.
Putting it out there.
I think it's good, and I think that we just need to keep putting it out there. And I think as well, we need to put, well, this is just my opinion, but I think my aim with this little mini series is to put it across in a, not in an aggressive way, like not in a, well, you're a white man and you're everything that's wrong with the world. That's not my intent here. My intent is to acknowledge that there's more white men doing a lot of stuff, and that there's a benefit to having less white men do it and mix it up a bit.
You know, a great phrase that somebody gave me is, and this is kind of what holds us back a little bit as well, is that, and you know, I've described how it gets worse the higher up the ladder that you go, is that somebody close to me was listening to a podcast. I can't even remember who did it, otherwise I'd acknowledge them. But she actually came off, she said, it's not about the fact that, you know, women are out to, you know, take your piece of the pie.
Yeah.
Because we just need to make more pies, you
know? Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I heard that before as well.
Yeah, so it's just not, I just think we need to create space for everybody.
And frankly, there's already enough pies. There's already enough pies. 100%. There is enough pies. We just need to be a little bit more inclusive in the way.
Yeah.
In my opinion. But no, I've heard that before as well. And I think it's good. Yeah. And it's not like we need less of this ethnicity or less of this gender. It's that we're not just going to put those, you know, put you out of the job. It's just, we just need to mix things up a bit. Because I think that when we have these conversations, it's so aggressive and it's so like targeted at people that the people that need to hear it switch off because they feel like they're being attacked. And I don't want to see that in our profession because we desperately need to do
we
better.
Need good people.
Definitely. Right, Louise, I'm going to tie that up because I can smell my dinner from downstairs and I'm going to go sit with my daughter for a little bit. And so would you like to just give a little shout out to your company if anyone likes what you're talking about and they want to do something?
Yeah, well, I'd say a first shout out is to anybody who's interested in One Wish. That's Women and Inclusion in Safety and Health. And we've got a LinkedIn page. So do have a look at that. I'd say just follow me on LinkedIn because I'm talking about this more and more. But yeah, I mean, if anybody wants to get in contact with me, I love chattering on LinkedIn. So that's probably the best way to make contact.
Great stuff. We'll put the
details.
Thank
you so much for having me, James. It's always great talking to you.
No, thank you very much for coming on. It was a good chat. Okay, peeps, hope you enjoyed that conversation with Louise. I thoroughly enjoyed it because I enjoy all of my chats because I like talking to people. So I really, really enjoyed it. Thank you very much, Louise, for coming on. It was a pleasure to talk to you, pleasure to hear about your career, your challenges, and just have a general chit-chat about diversity. Don't forget to check out Paradigm Human Performance and the Learning Organisation webinar that they run. Email address, phone number, website in the description below. So don't forget to check that. If you are a safety professional and you're looking to join a mastermind community, you're looking to shoot your professional development up the wazoo, then Project Meletium is a place for you. So please go check out that website in the description below. And if you're looking for any more help with safety, with risk management, anything like that, go and check out rebrandingsafety.com. We do loads of services. You're looking for a bit of a different keynote for your internal motivational workshop thingamajiggy, or maybe you're looking for something for your event. Maybe you're looking to promote your brand, and we offer media services as well. So please go and check out our website. Look at all the services that we provide, and I'm sure we can help each other out. And we would just love to work with members of our audience anyway, because it's just great fun. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for thinking about us if you do need any work. Thank you very much for checking out Paradigm and Project Meletium. And ultimately, thanks for being a listener. I'll catch you next week. Safe.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only based on limited and dated open source information and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson.